This is a speaker meeting. Stevie will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Delilah, who will share her experience, strength, and hope. Now I'd like to introduce Stevie.
Hello, I'm Stevie B. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Stevie.
I am really nervous. I haven't spoken before, and I'm just going to do my best. I got asked about 30 minutes ago, and my first reaction was, how can I say no and still, you know, be part of this fellowship? And my sponsors told me when AA shows up, you say yes, and that's what I'm doing right now. Basically, throughout my whole school career, I tried to kind of like lay under the radar, you know, like when it came time for reading out loud in class, I would shy away. Getting up in front of the groups, I would skip that class or whatever, you know what I mean? So I never really developed those skills. And, you know, it's kind of nerve-wracking being up here. I'd like to welcome the newcomers. If you're new, you signed up for a lot of awkwardness. You know, I'm only 4 months sober. I've been sober since March 12th is my sobriety date, and I still feel really socially awkward, you know? I started using at the age of 12. I'm 27. I used for about 13, 14 years solid. And I started really heavily right from the gates with prescriptions. My best friend's mom had terminal cancer, and we would go into her medicine cabinet, and we'd steal some really high, you know, powered narcotics from her. And so I started really young with heavy stuff, you know what I mean? And it just kind of progressed from there. Smoking weed every day, drinking. You know, I was pretty much a chemical dumpster. Anything and everything to get outside of the way I felt. And I used that way for, you know, I already said that. I used that way for, you know, until I was about 24. And looking back at it, you know, I didn't have too many negative consequences starting out until basically I got into high school and I got caught smoking in the bathroom. And they were like, are you smoking pot? And I was like, no. And there's like, you know, a cloud of smoke in the bathroom. And I got suspended, and then I got the option to basically, they're like, we could expel you or we can send you to this continuation school. And so I opted out to go to the continuation school, so I basically wouldn't have anything on my record as far as the expulsion or anything. And, I loved it, you know what I mean? Like, I only had to go to school, like, 20 hours a week, so it really enabled me to use the way I wanted to use, you know? At the age of 18, I met somebody that I fell in love with, and I basically... She got pregnant, and I wanted to do the right thing, and so I married her. You know, I'm 18 years old. I don't have any idea what marriage is going to be about, and I basically married her because she was pregnant, you know, not because I loved her. And the relationship was just a disaster from the start, you know. It was a very toxic and abusive relationship. On my end, you know, there's a misconception with domestic violence. You know, a lot of people think that it's only men beating women, but like it goes both ways, and I've experienced it. And you know, like I basically, throughout, like until I got married with this woman, I would get in these relationships with women because I wasn't able to love myself. So I seek love from other people to love me, because I thought if you love me, then there's something okay with me. You know what I mean? And it's not till just recently that basically I've started to develop some love for myself, you know. And so getting back to the relationship, so yeah, it was very abusive. Coming home, beer bottles broken over my head. And that continued for a few years, and then one day she called the cops because I restrained her and I left the bruise on her shoulder. And I did 6 months in a county jail. And so once, like, I got put on paper, basically, and once I got put on paper and with my drug habit was soaring, you know, so I went back to jail, like, basically 4 more times for, you know, 6 months or more, and it was all behind my addiction, you know. I'd go into these, basically, you know, Targets or stores, and I would lift stuff to support my habit. And the last time that I went, I was basically looking at 7 years in prison, you know, and I'm like, you know, I'm a pretty little white boy. I'm not, you know, cut out for prison time. I'm not a fighter, you know, I'm a lover. And my public defender, because I wasn't able to afford an attorney, opted out and asked if I'd be willing to go to treatment. And I did. I went to San Francisco Salvation Army, and I got accepted into the ARC, a work therapy program out there, and I did 2 months. And you know, just coming out of an abusive relationship and getting divorced while I was in jail, and then getting released, and there's women in this program. I basically, you know, I did something that they call fraternizing, and I was lonely, you know, and I needed some time. So they kicked me out of the program, you know, and I still have all this time, had all this time over my head, and I called my father, and I was like, yeah, I got kicked out for fraternizing. He said, what the hell did you go join in a fraternity for, you know? I said no, and I explained it to him, and he said, well, you know, you got yourself into it, you got to get yourself out of it. And it's by the grace of God that I called my PO, and she was out of town, so it enabled me basically a week to get into another program. And I got in, and I basically completed a year in that program, and I had like 2 years of sobriety at that point. And you know, as I got sober and I worked the steps, you know, life just kept getting better and better and better. And you know, I went to school for welding and started out in ironwork, you know, hanging steel and stuff, skyscrapers. And I'm afraid of heights, so it's like, you know, but it's been great, you know. But you know, life shows up, and I basically drift away from the program, and I stopped meeting with my sponsor regularly. The only meeting I was going to was the one that I secretaried at. It was like once a week. And one day I got a phone call out of the blue from my old dealer. And he's like, hey, I got that, da, da, da. And I was laid off for the week. So I started using again. And slowly but surely, my life started to unfold. And that was back in November, and this last November. And it was awful, man. Like, I fall back down to where I was, you know, back into lying, manipulation, and theft. And those are things that I really don't match up with my core values or my morals. You know, it's not something that I am today, and it's not something that I try to practice. My PO stopped drug testing me, and then this one day when I went in, I guess I just looked so spun out, she was like, we're going to give you a drug test. And I made some story about how I already peed and da da da. So I called her the next day and I told her I needed help. And she said, I'll allow you to go to treatment. And I went back to treatment. And that was in March 12th. I did 28 days. And since I've been out, you know, I've just been trying to basically. Is it time?
Like 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Basically, since I've been out, I've just been trying to reimmerse myself in this program. You know, I'm really uncomfortable asking people their names and for friendships and for phone numbers. You know, it's like, this feels really foreign to me, but that's been something I've been doing. I don't want to say anybody's name, but Victor was the secretary at the first meeting I went to when I got out. And I shared about how I was scared and I needed help, and him and a group of guys came up to me after the meeting, and they said, you're going to come fellowship. And I still keep in touch with a lot of those guys today, you know. And I love AA. There's times I want to hate AA. You know, it's like, oh, well, I got to go to this meeting, you know, I got this big life, or whatever, you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, well, what's giving me that life? And that's this program, it's the work, and it's people in this program. And you know, 4 months sober, I'm going through some really big changes. My girlfriend is moving to San Francisco, you know, it's going to be different. I mean, it's only across the bridge, right? I like to overthink this shit. I quit my job on, Friday?
Yeah.
Yeah, I quit my job yesterday, and I got picked up with the union, so, like I'm moving on up in my career, you know, like, I'm gonna have insurance and stuff for me and my son, and that's the first time I've ever had anything like that, you know. I'm just truly thankful and indebted to this program and to the people in it. And I'm gonna sit down because I want to sit down.
Hi everyone, I'm Delilah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Delilah.
Thank you so much for your story. He was telling me how nervous he was in the beginning, shaking, and I didn't want to tell you how nervous I was, because I thought I was going to make you nervous, but I was also nervous. Welcome to all of the newcomers, all of you that have less than 90 days, welcome to the visitors, and I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you so much, Jen, for asking me to speak, and I've never been to this meeting, I had no idea what to expect. And thank God you didn't tell me how big it was, because I would have been a lot more nervous than I am now. I get nervous when I'm asked to speak. And it's part of the reason why I always say yes, is because, you know, for me, it's really a chance to practice walking through, you know, what feels like a debilitating fear. And learning a lesson from that, and having faith that it's going to be okay. And having to do it in front of all of you. So I always say yes when I'm asked to speak. I also never prepare anything. And so, and that's for a couple reasons. It's because, one is because, you know, one of my major character defects is that I like to control things. And I'm sure none of you can relate to this. But I like to control the outcome. And when I come here and I'm open, and just try to be a vessel of what I think God's message should be and try to get myself out of it, it's just better for me, and I think it makes for a better share, because I'm getting warm. Because I have nothing to do with it. I just show up willing, and no matter what I say is exactly what needs to be said, right? I am a child of immigrants. I was born in Ethiopia, in a town called Addis Ababa. And I hear a recognition. Somebody recognized me. Thank God. It's in East Africa. I grew up in a really affluent, really wealthy family in Ethiopia, and we lived a good life. There is a lot of alcoholism in my family. I have an uncle, two uncles, both of them committed suicide as a result of this disease. I have an aunt that lived in Germany. She moved to Germany, married a German man, had a German child, and died in an institution from liver cirrhosis from this disease. And I have a father that still drinks. And so, you know, if you have absolutely nothing to be grateful for today, which I doubt that could be the case, be grateful that when you were ready to be sober, that AA was here for you and you had AA. Because for my uncles, who they both hung themselves from a tree, they did not have Alcoholics Anonymous in Ethiopia. They never heard the name, they never had a choice. They never went. They died from this disease, not having a choice. So I always remember that. It's just something I'll never, ever forget. My grandmother, who I'm really close to, lost three of those kids. So grew up in Ethiopia, relatively, you know, easy, beautiful childhood. When I was 11 years old, there was a major war that broke out in Ethiopia. My brother was 14. He was drafting age, which means that he could have been drafted into the war. My parents were very afraid of that. So my dad and my mother made the decision to send us to San Diego, California, where my aunt lived. And so, you know, this was very exciting for us at the time because, like, you know, here's America, right? Like, you know, we had this sort of expectation of what America was going to be, and it was a lot like what we saw. It was going to be on TV. It was going to be, you know, chocolate and hamburgers and shakes and Barbie dolls and beaches, and it was just going to be, like, everything. We landed in San Diego soil. My mom, my brother, my sister, and I, my dad stayed behind. And we quickly moved in with my aunt in a two-bedroom apartment. She had cats. I'm definitely allergic to cats. She was really depressed. She lived with her husband. They were going through a divorce. We had one bedroom. She had another. I mean, it was just like not at all what I thought it was going to be like. Life was actually really difficult for us. And my mom, you know, all our lives, she just had, you know, relied on my father to take care of her. And she had to have a career. She had to go to school and all of that. So, you know, we lived with my aunt for a little bit. And then quickly after, my mom moved us out of my aunt. And then we moved into a studio apartment. My brother, my sister, my mom, and I lived in a studio apartment. My mom was going to school. She was putting herself through nursing school. She was cleaning houses, and she was a banquet waitress, and we lived in a studio apartment. Not at all what I thought America was going to be. I was pissed. I was an angry, angry child, because it was like, what, why? Why did we leave that behind? Like, you know, there was nothing wrong with our Ethiopian life, and there was just like this like repressed anger that I felt, and I couldn't really show it. There's also this expectation when you're a child of an immigrant that because like the sacrifice that your parents, your family sort of like put in bringing you to America, there's this expectation that you sort of like bow your head, you do your chores, you do good in school, like you know, like shut the fuck up and just like be okay. Like, you know, like, come on. Like, we had to like leave a lot of shit behind to get you here. So just be a good kid, you know? So there was this expectation for us to be really good kids, and we couldn't rebel, we couldn't like, you know, we had to be good, and we were. My brother, my sister, and I were really good kids. And when my mom was going to school and left us home a lot, like, you know, we sort of, you know, she put us, my sister and I were in Catholic school, and we were, you know, good Catholic school girls, and, you know, we were good. Like, you know, life was just sort of cruising along. But, I mean, underneath it all, I think all three of us felt this very repressed sort of anger to our life here in America. And, you know, and later on we would all rebel in our own separate ways and react to that. So life is going along in San Diego. I do fine in school. I actually do really well in school. I got in at sixth grade. I spoke no English. None. I spoke Italian because we went to Italian private school when we were in Ethiopia. And I spoke Amharic, my native language. And I didn't. My mom put us in this Catholic school, and we said, "Well, how are we? You know, what, everything is taught in English. Just shut up. Don't ask any questions. You're smart kids. Just shut up. Go." And so we went. And I, you know, by the time I was I was just an awkward kid. I just was skinny, and I had braids, and I didn't speak the language. I had one weird friend, who's still my best friend to this day, Ariana, who was also like an outcast, and you know, whatever. And so, you know, I couldn't like do like recess and like, you know, like hang out with the kids. So the teacher quickly sort of took a liking to me, and so during like, you know, what would be like recess and lunchtime to sort of avoid the like awkward, like, I don't have any friends, I'm just hanging out with my weird kid here. She would just like, she would teach me English. And so by the time I was in seventh grade, I was in honors English because I have that kind of determination. I have that kind of like, oh yeah? Oh yeah? You know? So you know, life went along. And, you know, eighth grade, ninth grade, high school, was fine in high school. I was, here we go, I'm really going to admit this in the group level. I was a cheerleader. That was cool. Did fine in high school. And by the time I was in high school, my sister again, rebelling her own way, got caught up with this guy that was said that he was in high school. He wasn't in high school. He was 26 years old and had just had gotten out of jail for rape.
Oh.
Prince Charming. So she got caught up with him. She got in this. She was at that point a junior in high school, and got in a really incredibly abusive relationship with this guy. We didn't meet him. We didn't know who he was, but you know, all of this was kept sort of secret. And one time, after school, he picked her up from school and he kidnapped her. And she was missing for 4 days, and he dropped her off on the front steps of our house, completely unrecognizable, either senseless. And so, the family made a decision to pluck her out of that and send her to Ethiopia to live with my dad and to get away from him while we pressed charges. He continued to terrorize the family. We moved. We couldn't find. It was a really terrible experience. And I'm still in high school at this point, so my sister went from Ethiopia. She got sent to Minnesota to go to the University of Minnesota because they didn't want to send her back to California so that we wouldn't risk him finding her. So she went to Minnesota. By this time, I was done with high school. And then it was time for me to apply to colleges. And my sister said, please just come to Minneapolis. Come to Minneapolis and just let's be together. My sister and I were still very close. So I went to University of Minnesota. Still no drinking, still no drugs, still pretty, life still pretty manageable. I consider myself to be a pretty stable, well-adjusted human being. Nothing's fucked up. And I got accepted to the University of Minnesota to go to journalism school. It's a really good journalism school at the University of Minnesota. So I went and I started going to school there. And it's interesting when I talk about discovering alcohol, because I really do think it was like a gradual love affair. Like, it wasn't like love at first sight, like, you know, I hear a lot in these rooms, like, where I took a drink and I just went like, the elixir of the gods, you know, like, it wasn't like that. I honestly don't even really remember like the first time I tasted alcohol or had alcohol in my system. I definitely remember the first time I got like drunk and cried. I mean, I got drunk, I cried, I puked, and I felt like shit the next day. I mean, nothing unusual. But nothing unusual for us. But it was a very sort of gradual thing. So, I'm in college, I'm in Minnesota, and there's something about leaving San Diego, leaving my family. I'm sorry, let me back up. By the time when I was in high school, my grandmother, who's incredibly influential in my life, moved from Ethiopia and moved to California. And she sort of bridged the gap for us in terms of my dad wasn't around. There was a lot of free time that we had as kids in the home. And she was home a lot with us. And so she was kind of like at a time when we all felt this anger and this repression and felt loneliness and felt separate from and felt like isolated from, the rest of the world. My grandmother was an anchor for us. She really was this like stronghold in the family. So anyway, that'll be important later on in my story. That's why I introduced my grandmother. But so I'm in Minnesota. Life is going fine. My sister and I have an apartment, and we're drinking. We're drinking. I'm like, oh, okay, we're drinking. Oh, okay. Like, it's cute. Like, we're drinking. It's fine. No problems. I haven't suffered any consequences. It's good. It's still really cute. I start to realize that I really like alcohol, that I drink very differently from my sister. Oh wait, I drink differently from everybody. I stay out later. I black out. Oh shit, who's this? I start to see like a little bit of like the consequences from alcohol that are like, yeah, but it's still okay. It's still not crazy unmanageable, And My sister, we got an opportunity to live in Italy for a year, my sister and I, and study. I told you, my sister and I speak fluent Italian, so we went and we lived in Italy, and like, I discovered the kind of drinker I wanted to be. Like, yes, this is it. Like, for me, the fantasy of alcohol has always been like, fashion, fabulous, fantastic. Like, you know, just like, you know, it's just like a martini, it's like wine, it's champagne, it's like, it's cute, it's very like, you know, elusive and fun, and like, I'm the life of the party, you know, like, I know where all the best secret parties are. Like, I was just like, this is it. Like, I need alcohol as part of my persona. In fact, I have a persona when I'm you know, when I drink, right? It's like, I get it. And a lot of that kind of like childhood, like anger, repression, feeling different from, feeling displaced, feeling, you know, different from the very beginning. Like, a lot of that kind of disappears when I'm drinking, and I'm able to be like, you know, really confident and really gregarious and really just like loud and fun and sometimes really mean, like, you know, really mean. But, you know, it's all fine. It's all under the guise of this fun thing that we're doing. And I discovered cocaine, I discovered hashish, and I was, you know, all of that was just like perfect. It fit along with my constitution just well with me. And so that, in Italy, I learned what kind of like the persona of the person that I wanted to be. I wanted to be in fashion, I wanted to be drinking, I wanted drugs, I wanted that fabulous life. I wanted to be, you know, a fashion writer. Got back from Italy, my sister quickly graduated and left, and got a job with Yahoo and moved to California and met the man of her dreams and was engaged and moved back, and I stayed behind. And I had just two more years to finish school, and I just couldn't get it. I was like life is start, like, I'm starting to see the consequences now. I have a hard time waking up in the morning to go to school. I realize that I'm making terrible decisions, and my grades are really slipping. There was one time when I was put on probation, I had like all F's, not one. I got straight F's. And is that this one mine? This one's yours. This one's mine. Okay, thank you. Straight F's, you know, coming from a girl who was like, you know, bright and capable. It was just all falling down to shits, and I can see the consequences now. And I drop out of school, and I don't tell my family. And I have an apartment, I'm living on my own, my family's helping me pay for the apartment. They don't know that I've dropped out of college. I say things like, I'm just gonna take one or two classes, you know. I'm working like at Banana Republic, I get fired from Banana Republic. Again, I get fired from the other job, and then I get fired from another job. So now, not only have I dropped out of college, I can't seem to keep a job, and I am drinking more and more. I'm drinking more and more. I was never the type of person that drank alone. I never drank in the morning. I love that this is like the kinds of things that you hear. People are like, alcoholics. Well, I never drank alone. I never drank alone. You know, I didn't want to drink alone. I wanted to drink with other people. For me, drinking was very much like a build myself up and like social thing, you know? So I never drank alone. And I had a best friend who was a really close friend. She was like a sister to me. My whole family knew her. She was married. And she was married to one of us, a practicing one of us. And so he and I drank a lot together, and one night we got really inappropriate with each other, and she found out, and she called my family, and she let the cat out of the bag, and she said, you know, Delilah's dropped out of school a long time ago. I don't know how she pays the rent. She has developed a little problem with cocaine, and she's been drinking, and so my whole family found out, and my mom said, move back to San Diego, just leave everything and just come home. Well, my very strict Catholic Ethiopian mom had no idea how bad things had gotten for me, so when I went back and lived with her, it took her 2 weeks to say, get your shit out and get the fuck out of my house. And so I had I remember these were my last words to my mom too. Like I packed up all dramatic, like packed up my stuff. I was so mad at her, felt so entitled. And I like, I'm by the door and I was like, you remember mom that I have a God too. That's what I told her. Because she had, you know, she was really religious and really, and then was like, came down on me about God. So I packed up my stuff and I moved in with my grandma. Who had, at this point, she like had a, an, like a, not an assisted living, but like a, you know, like a place where they had, the old folks lived. And I was living with her under the guise of taking care of her. I was not taking care of her. And this was in San Diego. And I had many, many bottoms in that apartment. The one that's always difficult to say, and I always share it when I share, and I've never been able to get through it without without getting emotional. So I'm living with her. My grandmother knows exactly what's going on with me. She knows. And I'm hiding it. I'm trying to hide it the best that I can. But you know, things are happening with me. Like I'm not showing. I like call in sick to Thanksgiving. I don't show up to like Christmas or birthdays. My family staged an intervention. I mean, it's like it's getting bad. You know? I can't hold. I couldn't hold down a job hosting at an Italian restaurant because it was just too much responsibility. So you know, things are bad. And in my life, it looks nothing like that when, you know, when I had the fantasy of alcohol and what it was going to do for me, this fabulous girl that's in fashion. My life looked nothing like that. And I was living with my grandmother, and I was on a binge. I was on a four-day binge, two blocks away from where my grandmother lived, above a taco shop, living or staying in this house. This guy that I was sleeping with just because he had drugs and alcohol. And so I was outside, I was in this window frame smoking a cigarette. It was 6 o'clock in the morning on the 4 day binge, 6 o'clock in the morning. And because I hadn't been home for 4 days, my grandmother had to go and get her own groceries and she was 80 years old. Mm-hmm. And the grocery store just happens to be directly in front of this house that I was in. And I was then sitting in the window frame, and I look outside the window, and my grandmother like is passing with her bags, and she's she sets down her bags, and then she picks them up, and then she walks in front of me. And I wish I could tell you that was like the moment. I was like, and then I was sober after that. But no, I did another line and I kept going and I kept going for 2 more years. At 30 years old, I was living with my grandma. I was broke. Which by the way, even though I was living with my grandma, it didn't stop me from bringing men into her house. And putting her at risk. And I was stealing money from her purse. And to use. And at the tail end of my drinking, about 2 months before, I met this man. And there was something different about this man. And we drank and we used together as well. But he sat me down and he said, you know, there's something more here. Like, I feel like you kind of have lost your way. And he kind of just said that. And he went to Mexico and he did an Inipi ceremony, and he prayed for me for 8 hours, unbeknownst to me, in an Inipi. And he came back, and I'm married to him. He's sitting right there. And so I went to a speaker meeting one night on a Tuesday, August 10th, 2008. I raised my hand, and I said, I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. And no truer words had passed my lips. You know, I knew exactly what I was saying I wasn't testing it. I wasn't hiding. I was like, I'm an alcoholic. And immediately after at that meeting, there was a woman that came up to me and she said, you know, I'm going to be your sponsor. And she sponsored me. She walked me through the steps. You know, for me, my life began to change immediately after I got sober. Immediately after. You know, at 30 days, I got a job running fitting rooms at a vintage shop. This was a big deal for me, y'all. This was a big deal. You know, I couldn't hold down a job. So, you know, being given an opportunity to like work at a, you know, vintage clothes, which I love, fitting rooms, fantastic, I could do that. And I had no, you know, I had absolutely no ego about that. I wasn't like, do you know I worked for Marc Jacobs? Like, I wasn't like, you know, whatever. I was just like, fine, anything, absolutely anything you can do for me. And the job paid $8.50 an hour, so I got a job at a coffee shop so that I could supplement, and I was told to make an amends to my grandmother, a financial amends. I was paying my grandmother, I was paying my own way while I stayed there. And life began to change. I did a fourth step. I faced my part in a lot of the things that I'd done in my life. I was able to forgive myself and forgive my mother, ask for forgiveness. I mean, it was incredible. I had actually, I had no problem with believing in God. I think that I actually had it. I think I had a relationship with God, even when I was drinking. I did. Was it a working relationship? No, I'm not saying that. But I had a relationship, I had an awareness of God. I had an awareness of God. And so, you know, for me, a lot of the steps brought me, the steps brought me closer to an understanding and a relationship with God that worked, right? I got married sober. How much time do I have? I'm sorry.
Like 10 minutes.
Oh, 10 minutes. Fantastic. I'll give you the sober story in 10 minutes. So when I say that like life changed for me, I mean that like absolutely everything in my life changed. My friends changed. My relationship with my family changed. My job changed, my financial situation changed, where I lived. I mean, absolutely, like, my life looks nothing like it did when I was drinking and using. And, you know, I talk a lot about this with my sponsor. It's like, you know, I could list to you all of the most amazing things that I have received in sobriety and just, like, go down the list. But it's not like, oh, I got these things because I'm sober. It's I have been blessed with the capacity to achieve what I set out to achieve because I'm sober. And if any of those things are gone tomorrow, there's no attachment from me because I have the capacity to build and rebuild, right? So it's not, there's no attachment. Like, you know, one of the things that I dreamed and dreamed and dreamed about since I got sober and I got that, you know, job running a fitting room, you know, at $8.50 an hour, it was a really successful, they had, you know, the woman had multiple vintage shops, is, man, I want one of these for myself. I want one of these. I think I could really do that. And, you know, I spent the time there, learned how to do that. I have one of those for myself today in San Francisco. But honestly, that place could burn down tomorrow. It literally burned down. And it's not at all what is the joy for me. The joy for me was building that. All the everything that it took, the capacity to have built that, the capacity to have endured the rejection, the capacity to see the lessons not only in like the triumphs, but like the tribulations, the difficulties, right? Like the really difficult things that I've had to go through. It's not, you know, my husband that brings me the joy. It's all of the lessons that comes in from our marriage, the way that it's a mirror to so much growth for me, right? So, you know, one of the major ways my life looks so different today is that I feel more capable than I've ever felt before. And I feel also more capable of enduring loss than I've ever felt. You know, my grandmother, who's, you know, she's now 87 is really sick, you know, and I don't know if how long she's going to live with us, you know. And I have no regret with our relationship. Like, I was able to show up on a regular basis, and she's going to pass seeing me sober and married and, like, thriving, you know. And I can let go of her with like, with love. This is, none of this is in my constitution, you guys. Like, it is an absolutely, like, it is adherence to these principles. It is, like, all, everything that I have learned as a, in this program is what guides me. And everything I learned in this program is also what guides my relationship with my family, with my husband, with my employees, with my business, with my friends. You know, at how I am as a daughter, like all of those things, in all sorts of subtle and not so subtle and impactful ways, guides the way that I live my life today. I don't want to know an alternative. I don't know how other people do life without these things, but I can't imagine a life different from this one. You know, and I think, like, you know, you hear this a lot, but like I say, like, you know, if you would have told me the life that I would have today, you know, when I first walked in, like, I just, you know, I wouldn't have believed you. Because to me, you know what I thought sobriety was? To me, sobriety was how I felt between drinks. You know what I mean? It's like the time when I was like, you know, the time that I got really fucked up, I came to, I said, I'll never do this again. This is awful, horrible, apologies, shame, anger, resentment. And then waiting, embracing, and being like, okay, and knowing that I was going to drink again. Like, that's what sobriety looked like to me. I didn't want that. And God, how wrong I was. How wrong I was. And also, like, you know, that's the thing. Like, if I was, like, really wrong about that, how many things am I really wrong about? Like, all these things that I assume I know. You know, all of these things that are, like, I have judgment over. How I assume I know something, and I am completely wrong. And another gift of this program is the capacity to just say, I don't know. I just don't know. I'm really grateful to be sober. I'm really grateful to have been your speaker. I'm really grateful that I was able to speak for this long, because I thought I was going to be your 20-minute speaker today, not your 40-minute speaker. And I don't know any better way to live a life for an alcoholic than this one. I'm so grateful that, unlike my uncles who had committed suicide because they didn't have a solution, that, you know, some power that is greater than me, that was working for me before I ever recognized that it was working for me, planted me right here, and that I am sober, and the first one in my family to have been sober. So... thank you for...